I've known Naomi for almost 5 years, he told me. He ran his hand back through his longish blonde hair. I can feel a small fraction of what you're going through. And I'm so sorry, Alex. This has devastated a lot of us here. I thanked Dean Lowell, and left his office feeling touched by the man and somewhat better. I went off to the student dorms. Guess who's coming to high tea? Chapter 21. I felt like Alex in Wonderland. The main dormitory area at Duke was another idyllic spot. Smaller houses, a few cottages rather than the usual Gothic buildings. Meyer's quad was shaded by tall, ancient oaks and spreading magnolias, surrounded by well-kept flower gardens. Glory be to God for dappled things. A silver BMW convertible was parked in front of the place. The sticker on the Bimmer bumper read, "My daughter and my money go to Duke." Inside, the living room of the dorm had polished hardwood floors and respectably faded oriental rugs that could pass for the real thing. I took in the sights while I waited for Mary Ellen Clouk. The room was filled with overstuffed period chairs, couches, mahogany highboys. Bench seats were under both front windows. Mary Ellen Clouk came downstairs a few minutes after my arrival. I had met her half a dozen times before that Sunday afternoon. She was nearly 6 feet tall, ash blonde, and attractive, not unlike the women who had mysteriously disappeared. The body that was found half-eaten by birds and animals in the woods around Efland had once been a beautiful blonde woman, too. I wondered if the killer had checked out Mary Ellen Clouk. Why had he chosen Naomi? How did he make his final choices? How many women had been chosen so far?
"Hello, Alex. God, I'm glad you're here."
Mary Ellen took my hand and held it tightly. Seeing her brought on warm but also painful memories. We decided to leave the dorm and stroll out onto the rolling grounds of the West Campus. I'd always liked Mary Ellen. She'd been a history and psych major as an undergraduate. I remembered that we'd talked about psychoanalysis one night in D.C. She knew almost as much about psychic trauma as I did.
"Sorry I was away when you arrived in Durham," she said
as we walked east among elegant Gothic-style buildings that were built in the 1920s.
"My brother graduated from high school on Friday. Little Ryan Clouk. He's over 6'5", actually. 220 pounds if he's an ounce. Lead singer for Scratching Blackboards. I got back this morning, Alex."
"When was the last time you saw Naomi?" I asked Mary Ellen as we crossed onto a pretty street called Wanamaker Drive. It felt all wrong to be talking to Naomi's friend like a homicide detective, but I had to do it. The question had stung Mary Ellen. She took a deep breath before she answered me.
6 days ago, Alex. We drove down to Chapel Hill together. We were doing work there for Habitat for Humanity."
Habitat for Humanity was a community service group that rebuilt houses for the poor. Naomi hadn't mentioned that she did volunteer work for them. "Did you see Naomi after that?" I asked. Mary Ellen shook her head. The gold dancing bells around her neck jangled softly. I suddenly got the feeling that she didn't want to look at me.
"That was the last time, I'm afraid. I was the one who went to the police. I found out they have a 24-hour rule on most disappearances. Naomi was gone almost 2.5 days before they put out any all-points bulletins. Do you know why?" she asked.
I shook my head, but didn't want to make a big deal out of it in front of Mary Ellen. I still didn't know exactly why there was such a band of secrecy surrounding the case. I'd put in calls to Detective Nick Ruskin that morning, but he hadn't returned any of them.
"Do you think Naomi's disappearance has anything to do with the other women who have disappeared lately?" Mary Ellen asked.
Her blue eyes were pierced with pain.
"There could be a connection. There was no physical evidence at the Sarah Duke Gardens, though. Honestly, there's very little to go on, Mary Ellen.
If Naomi was abducted at a public garden right on the campus, there were no witnesses. She had been seen in the gardens half an hour before she missed a class in contracts. Casanova was scarily good at what he did. He was like a ghost. We finished our talk, ending up full circle where we had begun. The dormitory house was set back 20 to 30 yards from a graveled path.
It had high white columns, and the large veranda was crowded with shiny white wicker rockers and tables. The antebellum period, one of my favorites.
"Alex, Naomi and I really haven't been as close lately,"
Mary Ellen suddenly confided in me.
"I'm sorry, I thought you should know that."
Mary Ellen was crying as she leaned in and kissed me on the cheek. Then she ran up the polished, whitewashed stairs and disappeared inside. Another troubling mystery to solve. Chapter 22. Casanova watched Dr. Alex Cross. His quick, sharp mind was whizzing about like a sophisticated computer, possibly the fastest computer in the whole research triangle. "Look at Cross," he muttered. "Visiting Naomi's old friend. There's nothing to be found there, Doctor. You're not even warm yet. You're getting colder, actually." He followed Alex Cross at a safe distance as he walked across the Duke campus. He had read extensively about Cross. He knew all about the psychologist and detective who'd made his reputation tracking down a kidnapper killer in Washington. The so-called crime of the century, which was a lot of media hype and horseshit. "So who's better at this game?" he wanted to shout out to Dr. Cross. "I know who you are. You don't know dog shit about me. You never will." Cross stopped walking. He took a pad from the back pocket of his trousers and made a note. "What's this, Doctor? Had a thought of some consequence? I'd rather doubt that. I honestly do. The FBI, the local police, they've all been trailing me for months. I suppose they make notes, too, but none of them has a clue." Casanova watched Alex Cross continue to walk along the campus until he finally disappeared from sight. The idea that Cross would actually track and capture him was unthinkable. It simply wasn't going to happen. He started to laugh and had to catch himself, since the Duke campus was fairly crowded on a Sunday afternoon. "No one has a clue, Dr. Cross. Don't you get it? That's the clue." Chapter 23. I was a street detective again. I spent most of Monday morning interviewing people who knew Kate McTiernan. Casanova's latest victim was a first-year intern who'd been abducted from her apartment on the outskirts of Chapel Hill. I was attempting to put together a psych profile of Casanova, but there wasn't enough information. Period. The FBI wasn't helping. Nick Ruskin still hadn't returned my phone calls. A professor at North Carolina Med School told me that Kate McTiernan was one of the most conscientious students she'd taught in 20 years. Another professor at the school said that her commitment and intelligence were indeed high, but her temperament is the truly extraordinary thing about Kate. It was unanimous in that regard. Even competing interns at the hospital agreed that Kate McTiernan was something else. "She's the least narcissistic woman I've ever met," one of the woman interns told me. "Kate's totally driven, but she knows it, and she can laugh at herself," said another. "She's a really cool person. This is such a sad, numbing thing for everyone at the hospital." "She's a brain, who happens to be built like a brick shithouse." I called Peter McGrath, a history professor, and he reluctantly agreed to see me. Kate McTiernan had dated him for almost 4 months, but their relationship had ended abruptly. Professor McGrath was tall, athletic-looking, a bit imperious. "I could say that I fucked up royally by losing her," McGrath admitted to me. "And I did. But I couldn't have held on to the Katester. She's probably the strongest-willed person, man or woman, that I've ever met. God, I can't believe this has happened to Kate." His face was pale, and he was obviously shaken up by her disappearance. At least, he appeared to be. I ended up eating by myself in a noisy bar in the college town of Chapel Hill. There were hordes of university students and a busy pool table, but I sat alone with my beers, a greasy, rubbery cheeseburger, and my early thoughts on Casanova. The long day had drained me. I missed Samson, my kids, my home in D.C. A comfortable world without any monsters. Scoochie was still missing, though. So were several other young women in the Southeast. My thoughts kept drifting back to Kate McTiernan and what I'd heard about her today.
This is the way cases got solved. At least it was the way I had always solved them. Data got collected, data ran loose in the brain. Eventually, connections were made.
Casanova doesn't just take physically beautiful women, I suddenly realized in the bar. He takes the most extraordinary women he can find. He's taking only the heartbreakers, the women that everybody wants but nobody ever seems to get. He's collecting them somewhere out there. Why extraordinary women, I wondered.
There was one possible answer.
Because he believes he's extraordinary, too.
Chapter 24. I almost went back to see Mary Ellen Clark again, but I changed my mind and returned to the Washington Duke Inn. A couple of messages were waiting for me. The first was from a friend in the Washington PD. He was processing information I needed for a meaningful profile on Casanova. I'd brought a laptop with me, and I hoped I would be in business soon. A reporter by the name of Mike Hart had called four times. I recognized his name, and I knew his newspaper, a tabloid out of Florida called the National Star. The reporter's nickname was No Heart Hart. I didn't return No Heart's calls. I'd been featured on the front page of the Star once, and once was enough for this lifetime. Detective Nick Ruskin had finally returned one of my calls. He left a short message. Nothing new on our end. We'll let you know. I found that hard to believe. I didn't trust Detective Ruskin or his faithful sidekick, Davy Sykes. I drifted off to a restless sleep in a cozy armchair in my room and had the most vivid, nightmarish dreams. A monster right out of an Edvard Munch painting was chasing Naomi. I was powerless to help her. All I could do was watch the macabre scene in horror. Not much need for a trained psychotherapist to interpret that one. I woke up sensing that someone was in the hotel room with me. I quietly placed my hand on the butt of my revolver and stayed very still. My heart was pounding. How could someone have gotten into the room? I stood up slowly, but stayed low in a shooting crouch. I peered around as best I could in the semi-darkness. The chintz window drapes weren't completely drawn, so there was enough light from outside for me to make out shapes. Shadows of tree leaves danced on the hotel room wall. Nothing else seemed to be moving. I checked the bathroom, Glock pistol first, then the closets. I began to feel a little silly stalking the hotel room with my gun drawn, but I had definitely heard a noise. I finally spotted a piece of paper under the door. But I waited a few seconds before I flipped on the light, just to be sure. A black-and-white photograph was staring up at me. Instant associations and connections jumped to mind. It was a colonial British postcard, probably from the early 1900s. At that time, the postcards had been collected by Westerners as pseudo-art, but mostly as soft pornography. They had been a racy turn-on for male collectors in the early part of the century. I bent down to get a better look at the old-fashioned photo. The card showed an odalisk smoking a Turkish cigarette, in a startling acrobatic posture. The woman was dark, young, and beautiful, probably in her mid-teens. She was naked to the waist, and her full breasts hung upside down in the posed photograph. I flipped the card over with a pencil. There was a printed caption near where a stamp could be placed. Odalisks, with great beauty and high intelligence, were carefully trained to be concubines. They learned to dance quite beautifully, to play musical instruments, and to write exquisitely lyrical poetry. They were the most valuable part of the harem, perhaps the emperor's greatest treasure. The caption was signed in ink with a printed name. Giovanni Giacomo Casanova de Seingalt. He knew that I was here in Durham. He knew who I was. Casanova had left a calling card. Chapter 25.
I'm alive. Kate McTiernan slowly forced open her eyes inside a dimly lit room somewhere. For a couple of blinks of her eyes, she believed she was in a hotel that she couldn't for the life of her remember checking into. A really weird hotel and an even weirder Jim Jarmusch art movie. It didn't matter, though. At least she wasn't dead. Suddenly she remembered being shot point-blank in the chest. She remembered the intruder, tall, long hair, gentle, conversational voice. Sixth degree animal. She tried to get up, but thought better of it immediately. "Whoa there," she said out loud. Her throat was dry, and her voice sounded raspy as it echoed unpleasantly inside her head. Her tongue felt as if it needed a shave. "I'm in hell, in a circle from Dante's Inferno with a very low number," she thought, and she began to shiver. Everything about the moment was terrifying, but it was so horrible and so unexpected, she couldn't orient herself to it. Her joints were stiff and painful. She ached all over. She doubted that she could press 100 pounds right now. Her head felt huge, bloated like aging fruit, and it hurt. But she could vividly remember the attacker. He was tall, maybe 6'2", youngish, extremely powerful, articulate. The images were hazy, but she was absolutely certain they were true. She remembered something else about the monstrous attack in her apartment. He'd used a stun gun, or something like it, to immobilize her. He'd also used chloroform, or maybe it was halothane. That could account for her bruising headache. The lights had purposely been left on in the room. She noticed they were coming from modern-looking dimmers built into the ceiling. The ceiling was low, possibly under 7 feet. The room looked as if it had been recently built or remodeled. It was actually decorated tastefully, the way she might have done her own apartment if she had the money and time. A real brass bed, antique white dresser with brass handles, a dressing table with a silver brush comb mirror. There were colorful scarves tied on the bedposts, just the way she did them at home. That struck her as strange, very odd. There were no windows in the room. The only way out appeared to be through a heavy wooden door. "Nice decor," Kate muttered softly. "Early psycho. No, it's late psycho." The door to a small closet was open halfway, and she could see inside. What she saw made her feel physically ill. He'd brought her clothes to this horrible place, this bizarre prison cell. All of her clothes were here. Using her remaining strength, Kate McTiernan forced herself to sit upright in the bed. The effort made her heart race, and the pounding in her chest frightened her. Her arms and legs felt as if heavy weights were tied to them. She concentrated hard, trying to focus her eyes on the incredible scene. She continued to stare into the closet. Those weren't actually her clothes, she realized. He'd gone out and bought clothes just like hers, exactly to her taste and style. The clothes displayed in the closet were brand new. She could see some of the store tags dangling from the blouses and skirts. The Limited, The Gap in Chapel Hill, stores she actually shopped in herself. Her eyes darted to the top of the antique white dresser across the room. Her perfume was there, too. Obsession, Safari, Opium. He'd bought all of it for her, hadn't he? Next to the bed was a copy of All the Pretty Horses, the same book she had bought on Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. He knows everything about me. Chapter 26. Dr. Kate McTiernan slept, awoke, slept some more. She made a joke of it, called herself Lazy Bones. She never slept in, not since before med school, anyway. She was beginning to feel more clear-headed and alert, more in command of herself, except that she had lost track of time. She didn't know if it was morning, noon, or night, or even which day it was. The man, whoever the bastard was, had been inside the mysterious, despicable room while she slept. The thought made her physically ill. There was a note propped on the bedside table where she was sure to see it. The note was handwritten. "Dear Dr. Kate," it said. Her hands were trembling as she read her own name. "I wanted you to read this so that you understand me better and also the rules of the house. This is probably the most important letter you'll ever receive, so read it carefully, and please take it very seriously. No, I am not crazy or out of control. Actually, I'm quite the opposite. Apply your obviously high intelligence to the concept that I'm relatively sane, and that I know exactly what I want. Most people don't know what they want. Do you, Kate? We'll talk about that later. It's a subject worthy of much lively and interesting discussion. Do you know what you want? Are you getting it? Why not?
For the good of society? Whose society? Whose life are we living, anyway? I won't pretend that you are happy to be here, so no false-sounding welcomes. No cellophaned basket of fresh fruit and champagne. As you will soon see, or have already, I've tried to make your stay as comfortable as possible, which brings up an important point, perhaps the most important point of this first attempt at communication between us. Your stay will be temporary. You will leave if, big if, you listen to what I tell you. So listen carefully, Kate. Are you listening now? Please listen, Kate. Chase away the justifiable anger and the white noise in your head. I am not crazy or out of control. That's the whole point. I am in control. See the distinction? Of course you do. I know how very bright you are, a National Merit Scholar and all that. It is important that you know how special you are to me. That's why you are completely safe here. It is also why you'll leave, eventually. I picked you from thousands and thousands of women at my disposal, so to speak. I know you're saying, lucky me. I know how funny and cynical you can be. I even know that laughter has gotten you through difficult times. I'm beginning to know you better than anyone has ever known you. Almost as well as you know yourself, Kate. Now for the bad parts. And, Kate, these next points are as important as any of the good news I've stated above. These are the house rules, and they are to be strictly observed. 1. The most important rule. You must never try to escape, or you will be executed within hours, however painful that would be for both of us. Believe me, there is precedent for this. There can be no reprieve following an escape attempt. 2. Just for you, Kate, a special rule. You must never try to use your karate skills on me. I almost brought your gi, your crisp white karate suit, but why encourage you to temptation? 3. You must never call out for help. I'll know if you do, and you will be punished with facial and genital disfigurement. You want to know more? You want to know everything at once. But it doesn't work that way. Don't bother trying to figure out where you are. You won't guess, and will only give yourself an unnecessary headache. That's all for now. I have given you more than enough to think about. You are totally safe here. I love you more than you can imagine. I can't wait for us to talk. Really talk. Casanova. And you are hopelessly out of your mind, Kate McTiernan thought as she paced the 11-by-15-foot room. Her claustrophobic prison, her hell on this earth. Her body felt as if it were floating, as if warm, viscous fluid were flowing over her. She wondered if she'd suffered a head injury during the attack. She had only one thought, how to escape. She began to analyze her situation in every possible way. She reversed the conventional assumptions and broke down each to its component parts. There was a single, double-locked, thick wooden door. There was no way out other than through that door. No. That was the conventional assumption. There had to be another way. She remembered a problem-solution puzzle from some heretofore useless undergrad logics course she had taken. It began with 10 matchsticks arranged as Roman numerals in a math equation 11 plus 1 equals X, XI plus I equals X. The problem was how to correct the equation without touching any of the matches, without adding new matches, without taking away any matches. No easy way out. No apparent solution. The problem had been unsolvable to many students, but she had figured it out relatively quickly. A solution was there where none seemed to be. She solved it by reversing the conventional assumptions. She turned the page upside down. 10 equals 1 plus 9. X equals I plus IX. But she couldn't turn this prison room upside down, or could she? Kate McTiernan examined every single floorboard and each 2x4 on the wall. The wood smelled new. Maybe he was a builder, a contractor, or perhaps an architect. No way out. No apparent solution. She couldn't, wouldn't accept that answer. She thought about seducing him, if she could force herself to do it. No, he was too clever. He would know. Worse than that, she would know. There had to be a way. She would find it. Kate stared down at the note on the bedside table. You must never try to escape, or you will be executed within hours. Chapter 27. The following afternoon I visited the Sarah Duke Gardens, the place where Naomi had been abducted 6 days ago. I needed to go there, to visit the scene, to think about my niece, to grieve in private. There were more than 50 acres of exquisitely landscaped woodland gardens adjacent to the Duke University Medical Center, literally miles of alleys. Casanova couldn't have hoped for a better site for his kidnapping. He had been thorough. Perfect, so far. How was that possible? I talked to staff members, and also to a few students who had been there the day Naomi disappeared. The picturesque gardens were officially open from early morning until dusk. Naomi had last been seen at around 4 o'clock. Casanova had taken her in broad daylight. I couldn't figure out how he'd done it, not yet. Neither could the Durham police or the FBI. I walked around the woods and gardens for almost 2 hours. I was overwhelmed by the thought that Scoochie had been taken right here. A spot called the Terraces was particularly beautiful. Visitors could enter through a wisteria-covered pergola. Lovely wooden stairways led down to an irregular-shaped fish pond, with a rock garden stacked directly behind. Visually, the terraces were horizontal bands of rock, accented by stripes of the most beautiful color. Tulips, azaleas, camellias, irises, and peonies were in bloom. I knew instinctively that this was a place that Scoochie would love. I knelt near a visually striking patch of bright red and yellow tulips. I was wearing a gray suit with an open-necked white shirt. The ground was soft and stained my trousers, but it didn't matter. I bowed my head low. Finally, I wept for Scoochie. Chapter 28. Tick-tock, tick-tock. Kate McTiernan thought that she'd heard something. She was probably imagining it. You could definitely get a little buggy in here. There it was again. The slightest creak in the floorboards. The door opened, and he walked into the room without saying a word. There he was, Casanova. He had on another mask. He looked like some kind of a dark god, slender and athletic. Was that his fantasy image of himself? Physically, he would be considered a hunk at the university, or even as a cadaver in an autopsy room, which was preferable to her. She noted his clothes— tight, faded blue jeans, black cowboy boots, edged with soil, no shirt. He was definitely a hard body, proud of his rippling chest. She was trying to remember everything, for the time when she escaped. "I read all your rules," Kate said, trying to act as calm as possible. Her body was shivering, though. "They're very thorough, very clear." "Thank you. No one likes rules, least of all me, but they're necessary sometimes." The mask hid his face and it held Kate's attention. She couldn't take her eyes away from it. It reminded her of the elaborate decorative masks from Venice. It was hand-painted, ritualistic in its artistic detail, and weirdly beautiful. Was he trying to be seductive, Kate wondered? Was that it? "Why do you wear the mask?" she said. She kept her voice subservient, curious, but not demanding. "As I said in my note, one day you'll go free. You'll be released. It's all in my plan for you. I couldn't bear to see you hurt." "If I'm good. If I obey." "Yes, if you're good." "I won't be that hard, Kate. I like you so much." She wanted to hit him, to go after him. "Not yet," she warned herself. "Not until you're sure. You'll only get one try at him." He seemed to read her mind. He was very quick, very bright. "No karate," he said, and she sensed that he was smiling behind the mask. "Please remember that, Kate. I've actually seen you perform at your dojo.
I've watched you. You're very quick, and you're strong. So am I. I'm no stranger to martial arts.
That wasn't what I was thinking about.
Kate frowned and looked up at the ceiling. She rolled back her eyes. She thought it was pretty fair acting under the pressure circumstances. No threat to Emma Thompson or Holly Hunter, but decent.
I'm sorry, then. I apologize, he said.
I shouldn't put words in your mouth. I won't do it again, that's a promise. He seemed almost sane at times, and that terrified her more than anything else so far. It was as if they were having a nice normal chat in a nice normal house, not in his house of horrors.
Kate looked at his hands. The fingers were long and might even be considered elegant. An architect's? A doctor's hands? An artist's? Certainly not a working man's hands.
Well, what do you have in mind for me?
Kate decided on the direct approach.
Why am I here? Why this room, the clothes, all my things?
His voice remained gentle and calm. He was actually trying to seduce her.
Oh, I guess I want to fall in love, to stay in love for a while. I want to feel real romance every day that I possibly can. I want to feel something special in my life. I want to experience intimacy with another person. I'm not that different from everyone else, except that I act instead of daydream.
Don't you feel anything?
She asked. She feigned concern for him. She knew that sociopaths couldn't feel emotion. At least, that was her understanding. He shrugged. She sensed that he was smiling again, laughing at her.
Sometimes I feel a great deal. I think that I'm too sensitive. May I tell you how beautiful you are?
Under the present circumstances, I wish you wouldn't.
He laughed a nice laugh and shrugged his shoulders again.
Okay, that's settled then, isn't it? No sweet talk for the two of us. Not for now, anyway. Bear in mind, I can be romantic. I actually prefer it that way.
She wasn't prepared for his sudden movement, his quickness. The stun gun appeared and hit her with a vicious jolt. She recognized the gun's crackling sound, smelled the ozone. Kate fell back hard against the bedroom wall and cracked her head. The impact shook the whole house, wherever she was being kept.
Oh, Jesus, no,
Kate moaned softly. He was all over her, flailing arms and legs, all of his weight pressing down on her. He was going to kill her now. Oh, God, she didn't want to die like this, to have her life end in this way. It was so pointless, absurd, sad. She felt a fierce and explosive rage swelling up in her. With a desperate effort, she managed to kick out one leg, but she couldn't move her arms. Her chest was on fire. She could feel him ripping off her blouse, touching her all over. He was aroused. She could feel him rubbing against her.
No, please no,
she moaned. Her own voice sounded very far away. He was kneading her breasts with both hands. She could taste blood and feel its warm trickle from the corner of her mouth. Kate finally began to cry. She was choking, and she could hardly breathe.
I tried to be nice, he said through tightly gritted teeth.
He stopped suddenly. He got up and unzipped his blue jeans and yanked them down around his ankles. He didn't bother to take them off. Kate stared up at him. His penis was large, fully erect and bright with pulsing blood and thick veins. He threw himself down on her and rubbed it against her body, moving it slowly against her breasts, her throat, and then her mouth and eyes. Kate began to drift in and out of consciousness, in and out of reality. She tried to hold on to each thought that came to her. She needed to feel some control, even if it was only over her thoughts.
"Keep your eyes open," he warned her in a deep growl. "Look at me, Kate. Your eyes are so beautiful. You're the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. Do you know that? Do you know how desirable you are?"
He was in a trance now. It seemed like that to Kate. His powerful body danced, snaked, writhed, as he thrust himself in and out of her. He sat up and he played with her breasts again. He caressed her hair, different parts of her face. His touch became gentle after a while. That made it even worse for her. She felt such humiliation and horrible shame. She hated him.
I love you so much, Kate. I love you more than I'm capable of saying. I've never felt this way before. I promise you I haven't. Never like this. He wasn't going to kill her, Kate realized. He was going to let her live. He was going to come back again and again whenever he wanted her. The horror was overwhelming, and Kate finally passed out. She let her spirit fall far away. She didn't feel it when he gave her the softest kiss goodbye. I love you, sweet Kate, and I'm truly sorry about this. I do feel everything.
Chapter 29. I received an urgent phone call from a law student and classmate of Naomi's. She said her name was Florence Campbell, and that she had to talk to me as soon as possible.
I really must talk with you, Dr. Cross. It's imperative, she said.
I met her on the Duke campus near the Bryan University Center. Florence turned out to be a black woman in her early 20s. We walked among the magnolias and well-kept Gothic-style school buildings. Neither of us looked as if we particularly belonged in the setting. Florence was tall and gawky and somewhat mystifying at first. She had a stiff, high hairstyle that made me think of Nefertiti. Her appearance was decidedly odd, or maybe old-fashioned, and it struck me that people like her might still exist in rural Mississippi or Alabama. Florence had done her undergraduate work at Mississippi State University, which was about as far away from Duke University as you could get.
"I'm very, very sorry, Dr. Cross," she said as we sat on a stone and wood bench with student memorabilia etched into its rails. "I apologize to you and your family."
"You apologize about what, Florence?" I asked her. I didn't understand what she meant.
"I didn't make the effort to talk to you when you came to the campus yesterday. No one had made it clear that Naomi might actually have been kidnapped. The Durham police certainly didn't. They were just rude. They didn't seem to think Naomi was in any real trouble."
"Why do you think that is?" I asked Florence a question that was bouncing around inside my own head. She stared deeply into my eyes.
"Because Naomi's an Afro-American woman. The Durham police, the FBI, they don't care about us as much as they do about the white women."
"Do you believe that?" I asked her. Florence Campbell rolled her eyes.
"It's the truth, so why wouldn't I believe it? Franz Fanon argued that racist superstructures are permanently embedded in the psychology, economy, and culture of our society. I believe that, too."
Florence was a very serious woman. She had a copy of Albert Murray's The Omni-Americans under her arm. I was beginning to like her style. It was time to find out what secrets she knew about Naomi. "Tell me what's going on around here, Florence. Don't edit your thoughts because I'm Naomi's uncle, or because I'm a police detective. I need somebody to help me out. I am resisting a superstructure down here in Durham." Florence smiled. She pulled a tangle of hair away from her face. She was part Immanuel Kant, part Prissy from Gone with the Wind.
"Here's what I know so far, Dr. Cross. This is why some girls in the dorm were upset with Naomi."
She took a sip of the magnolia-fragrant air.
"It started with a man named Seth Samuel Taylor. He's a social worker in the projects of Durham. I introduced Naomi to Seth. He's my cousin."
Florence suddenly looked a little uncertain as she talked. "I don't see a problem so far," I told her.
"Seth Samuel and Naomi fell in love around December of last year," she went on. "Naomi was walking around with a starry night look in her eyes, and that's not like her, as you know. He came to the dorm at first, but then she started staying at Seth's apartment in Durham."
I was a little surprised that Naomi had fallen in love and hadn't mentioned it to Scylla. Why didn't she tell any of us about it? I still didn't understand the problem with the other girls at the dorm. I'm pretty sure Naomi wasn't the first co-ed to fall in love at Duke, or to have a man over for tea and crumpets and whatever, I said.
She wasn't just having a man over for whatever. She was having a black man over for whatever. Seth would show up from the projects in his dusty overalls and dusty work boots and his leather engineering jacket. Naomi started to wear an old sharecropper's straw hat around campus. Sometimes Seth wore a hard hat with slave labor written on it. He dared to be a little caustic and ironic about the sisters' social activity, and heaven forbid their social awareness. He scolded the black housekeepers when they tried to do their jobs.
"What do you think about your cousin Seth?" I asked Florence.
"Seth has a definite chip on his shoulder. He's angry about racial injustice to the point where it gets in the way of his ideas sometimes. Other than that, he's really great. He's a doer, not afraid to get his hands dirty. If he wasn't my distant cousin, Florence said with a wink. I had to smile at Florence's sneaky sense of humor. She was a little Mississippi gawky, but she was a neat lady. I was even starting to like her high hairstyle. "You and Naomi were fast friends?" I asked her. "We weren't at first. I think we both felt we were competing for law review. Probably only one black woman could make it, you understand. But as our first year wore on, we got very close. I love Naomi. She's the greatest."
I suddenly wondered if Naomi's disappearance might be connected to her boyfriend and maybe had nothing to do with the killer loose in North Carolina.
"He's a real good person. Don't go hurting him," Florence warned me. "Don't even think about it."
I nodded. "I'll only break one of his legs."
"He's strong as an ox," she came back at me.
"I am an ox," I told Florence Campbell, imparting a little secret of my own. Chapter 30. I stared into the dark eyes of Seth Samuel Taylor. He stared back. I kept on staring. His eyes looked like jet-black marbles set in almonds. Naomi's boyfriend was tall, very muscular, and working man hard. He reminded me more of a young lion than an ox. He looked disconsolate, and it was hard for me to question him. I had the premonition that Naomi was gone forever. Seth Taylor hadn't shaved, and I could tell that he hadn't slept in days. I don't think he had changed his clothes, either. He had on a badly wrinkled blue plaid shirt over a T-shirt and holy 501s. He still wore his dusty work boots. Either he was very upset, or Seth Taylor was a shrewd actor. I put out my hand, and his handshake was powerful. I felt as if I'd been put into a carpenter's vise. "You look like shit," were Seth Taylor's first words to me. Digital Underground was blaring out the Humpty Dance somewhere in the neighborhood, just like it was D.C., only a little behind the times. "You do, too." "Well, fuck y'all," he said. It was a familiar greeting on the streets, and we both knew it and laughed. Seth's smile was warm and somewhat contagious. He had an overconfident air about him, but it wasn't too obnoxious. Nothing I hadn't seen before. I could see that his broad nose had been broken a few times, but he was still good-looking in a rough-hewn sort of way. His presence dominated a room as Naomi's did. The detective in me wondered about Seth Taylor. Seth lived in an old working-class area north of downtown Durham. At one time, the neighborhood had been filled with tobacco factory workers. His apartment was a duplex in an old, shingled house that had been converted into two apartments. Posters of Arrested Development and Ice-T were up on the hallway walls. One poster read, "Not since slavery has so much ongoing catastrophe been visited on black males." The living room was filled with his friends and neighborhood folks. Sad Smokey Robinson songs played from a blaster. The friends were there to help in the search for Naomi. Finally, maybe I had some allies in the South. Everyone at the apartment was anxious to talk to me about Naomi. None of them had any suspicions about Seth Samuel. I was struck in particular by a woman with wise, sensitive eyes and skin the color of coffee with cream. Keisha Bowie was in her early 30s, a postal worker in Durham. Naomi and Seth had apparently talked her into going back to college to get her degree in psychology. She and I hit it off right away.
"Naomi is educated, so articulate. But you already know that."
Keisha took me aside and talked seriously to me.
"But Naomi never, ever uses her abilities or education to belittle someone else, or make herself seem superior. That struck every one of us when we met her. She's so down to earth, Alex. She doesn't have a phony bone inside her. That this could happen to her is the saddest thing."
I talked with Keisha some more, and I liked her very much. She was smart and pretty, but this wasn't the time for any of that stuff. I looked for Seth and found him off by himself on the second floor. The bedroom window was open, and he was sitting outside on the gently sloping roof. Robert Johnson was singing his haunting blues somewhere in the dark. "Mind if I come out and join you? This old roof hold us both?" I said from the window. Seth smiled. "If it doesn't, and we both crash through to the front porch, it'll be a good story for everybody. Worth the fall and the broken neck. Come on out. You got a mind, too?" He spoke in a sweet,
almost musical drawl. I could see why Naomi would like him. I climbed out and sat with Seth Samuel in the darkness settling over Durham. We heard a smaller-town version of the police sirens and excited shouts of the inner city. "We used to sit out here," Seth muttered in a low voice. "Naomi and I..." "You okay?" I asked him. "Nah. Never been any worse in my life. You?" "Never worse." "After you called," Seth said, "I was thinking about this visit. About this talk that we'd eventually have. I tried to think the way that you might be thinking. You know, like a police detective. Please don't have any more thoughts that there's some chance that I could have anything to do with Naomi's disappearance. Don't waste time on that." I looked over at Seth Samuel. He was hunched over, and his head rested on his chest. Even in the dark, I could see that his eyes were shiny wet. His grief was a palpable thing. I wanted to tell him that we were going to find her and that everything would work out. But I knew no such thing. We finally held on to each other. We were both missing Naomi in our own way, mourning together on the dark roof. Chapter 31. A friend of mine from the FBI finally returned one of my phone calls that night. I was doing some reading when he called, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. I was working on Casanova's profile and still not getting very far. I had originally met Special Agent Kyle Craig during the long, difficult manhunt for the serial kidnapper Gary Sonagy. Kyle had always been a straight shooter. He wasn't territorial like most FBI agents, and not too uptight by bureau standards either. Sometimes I thought that he didn't belong in the FBI. He was too much of a human being. "Thanks for finally returning my calls, stranger," I said over the phone. "Where are you working out of these days?" Kyle surprised me with his answer. "I'm here in Durham, Alex. To be a little more precise, I'm in the lobby of your hotel. Come on down for a drink or three in the infamous Bull Durham room. I need to talk to you. I've got a special message for you from J. Edgar himself." "I'll be right down. I've been wondering what the Hoove's been up to since he faked his own death." Kyle was seated at a table for two beside a large bay window. The window faced directly onto the putting green of the university golf course. A lanky man, who looked like a schoolboy, was teaching a Duke co-ed how to putt in the dark. The jock was standing behind his lady, showing her his best putt-putt moves. Kyle was watching the lesson of the links with obvious amusement. I watched Kyle with obvious amusement. He turned as if he could sense my presence. "Man, you have a nose for bad trouble," he said by way of a greeting. "I was sorry to hear that your niece is missing. It's good to see you, in spite of the particularly vile and shitty circumstances." I sat down across from the agent, and we started to talk shop. As always, he was extremely upbeat and positive without sounding naive. It's a gift he has. Some people feel that Kyle could wind up at the top of the bureau, and that it would be the best thing that ever happened. "First, the Honorable Ronald Burns appears in Durham. Now you show up. What gives?" I asked Kyle. "Tell me what you have so far," he said. "I'll try to reciprocate as much as I can." "I'm doing psych profiles on the murdered women," I told Kyle. "The so-called rejects. In two of the cases, the rejected women had very strong personalities. They probably gave him a lot of trouble. That could be why he killed them, to get rid of them. The exception was Betty Ann Ryerson. She was a mother in therapy, and she might have had a nervous breakdown." Kyle massaged his scalp with one hand. He was also shaking his head. "You've been given no information, no help whatsoever. But zippity-doo-da," he smiled at me, "you're still a half-step ahead of our people." "I haven't heard that theory about the rejects. It's pretty good, Alex, especially if he's a control freak." "He could definitely be a control freak, Kyle. There has to be a damn good reason why he got rid of those three women. Now, I thought you were going to tell me some things I didn't know." "Maybe if you pass a few more simple tests, that is. What else have you figured out?" I bad-eyed Kyle while I slowly sipped my beer. "You know, I thought you were all right, but you're just another FBI prick." "I was programmed at Quantico,"
Kyle said in a passable computer voice. "Have you done a psych profile on Casanova?"
"I'm working on it."
I told him what he already knew. "As much as I can with virtually no information available." Kyle beckoned with the cupped fingers of his right hand. He wanted it all, and then maybe he'd share something with me. "He has to be someone who blends into the community well," I said. "No one's even come close to catching him. He's probably driven by the same obsessive sexual fantasies that he's had since he was a boy. He could have been a victim of abuse, maybe incest. Maybe he was a peeping Tom, a rapist, or a date rapist. Now, he's a very fancy collector of extremely beautiful women. He seems to choose only the extraordinary ones. He's researching them, Kyle. I'm almost sure of it. He's lonely. Maybe he wants the perfect woman." Kyle shook his head back and forth.
"You are so goddamn crazy, man. You think like him."
"Not funny." I grabbed Kyle's cheek between my thumb and forefinger. "Now you tell me something I don't know." Kyle pulled away from my cheek hold. "Let me run a deal by you, Alex. This is a good deal, so don't get cynical on me." I raised my hand high in the air for the table waitress.
"Check. Separate checks, please."
"No, no, wait. This is a good deal, Alex. I hate to say trust me, but trust me. Just to prove my truthfulness, I simply can't tell you everything right now. I'll admit that the case is definitely bigger than anything you've seen so far. You're right about Burns. The deputy director wasn't down here by accident."
I figured Burns wasn't here to see the azaleas. I felt like yelling at Kyle inside the quiet hotel bar.
"Okay. Tell me one thing I don't know already." "I can't tell you any more than I already have."
"Damn you, Kyle, you haven't told me a goddamn thing." I raised my voice.
"What's the deal you have for me?" He put up a hand. He wanted me calm for this. "Listen. As you know or suspect, this is already a four-star multi-jurisdictional nightmare, and it hasn't really heated up yet. Believe me on that. Nobody's getting anything done, Alex. Here's what I'd like you to consider."
My eyes rolled back. "I'm glad I'm sitting down for this," I said.
"This is an excellent offer for a man in your position to consider. Since you're already outside the multi-jurisdictional mess, and therefore immune to it, why don't you keep it that way? Stay on the outside, and work directly with me."
"Work with the Federal Bureau?"
I choked on my beer. "Collaborate with the Phoebes?" "I can give you access to all the information we get as soon as we get it. I'll give you everything you need in terms of resources and information, and all of our current data."
"And you don't have to share anything I come up with? Not even with the local or state police?" I said.
Kyle had become his intense self again. "Look, Alex, this investigation is large and expensive, but it's getting nowhere. Officers are falling over one another while women all over the South, including your niece, are disappearing right under our noses."
"I understand the problem, Kyle. Let me think about your solution. Give me a little space on this one."
Kyle and I talked some more about his offer, and I was able to pin him down on a few specifics. Basically, I was sold, though. Working with Kyle would give me access to a first-rate support team, and I'd have clout whenever I needed it. I wouldn't be alone anymore. We ordered burgers and more beers and continued to talk and put the final touches on my deal with the devil. For the first time since I'd come south, I was feeling a little hopeful.
"I do have something else to share with you," I finally told him.
"He dropped me a note last night. It was a nice note, thoughtful, welcoming me to the area."
"We know." Kyle grinned like the grown-up Andy Hardy that he is. "It was a postcard, actually. It showed an odalisque, a love slave from a harem."
Chapter 32 By the time I got back to my room, it was a little late, but I called Nana and the kids anyway. I always call home when I'm away, twice every day, morning and night. I hadn't missed yet and didn't plan to start that night. "Are you listening to Nana and being a good girl for a change?" I asked Jenny when she came on the phone.
"I'm always a good girl,"
Jenny squealed with little girl glee. "She loves talking to me. I feel the same way about her."
Amazing, we were still madly in love after 5 years together. I closed my eyes and visualized my girl. I could just see her puffing out her little chest, making her face look defiant, but smiling pointy crooked teeth at the same time. Once Naomi had been a sweet little girl like that. I remembered everything about those times. I chased away the thought, the vivid portrait of Scoochie. Well, how about your big brother? Damon says he's being especially good, too. He says Nana's called you the Holy Terror today. Is that so?
Uh-uh, Daddy. That's what Nana called him. Damon's the Holy Terror in this house. I'm Nana's angel all the time. I'm Nana Mama's good girl angel. You can ask her.
Uh-huh. That's good to hear, I told my little spin doctor. Did you pull Damon's hair just a tiny bit at Roy Rogers' junk food restaurant today?
Not junk food, Polly Wally. He pulled my hair first. Damon almost pulled my hair out, like I was Baby Claire without her hair now.
Baby Claire had been Janny's main doll since she was 2 years old. The doll was her baby, absolutely sacred to Janny. Sacred to all of us. Once we had left Baby Claire at Williamsburg during a day trip, and we had to drive all the way back. Magically, Claire was waiting for us at the front gate office, having a nice chat with the security guard.
I couldn't pull Damon's hair anyway. He's almost bald, Daddy. Nana got him his summer haircut. Where do you see my bald brother? He's a pool ball.
I could hear her laughing. I could see Janny laughing. In the background, Damon wanted the phone back. He wanted his rebuttal about the state of his haircut. After I finished with the kids, I talked to Nana.
How are you holding up, Alex?
She went right to the point, as she always does. She would have made an outstanding detective or anything else she wanted to be.
Alex, I asked how you're doing.
I'm doing just fine and dandy. Love my work, I told her. How are you, old woman?
Never mind that. I could watch these children in my sleep. You don't sound good to me. You're not sleeping and you haven't made a lot of progress, have you?
Man, she was tough when she wanted to be. It's not going as well as I would have hoped, I told her. Something good might have just happened tonight.
I know, Nana said. That's why you're calling up so late. But you can't share the good news with your grandmother. You're afraid I might call the Washington Post.
We'd had this discussion before on cases I was working on. She always wants inside information, and I can't give it up. I love you, I finally said to her. That's the best I can do right now.
And I love you, Alex Cross. That's the best I can do.
She had to have the final word. After I finished with Nana and the kids, I lay in the dark on the unmade, unwelcoming hotel bed. I didn't want maids or anyone else in the room, but the Do Not Disturb tag hadn't deterred the FBI. A bottle of beer sat upright on my chest. I slowed my breathing, let the bottle balance there. I never liked hotel rooms, not even on a vacation. I started thinking about Naomi again. When she was a little girl like Janny, she used to ride up on my shoulder so she could see far, far away in the big people's world. I remembered that Naomi thought Christmas was Kissmas, so she would kiss everybody during the holidays. Finally, I let my mind settle on the monster who had taken Scoochie away from us. The monster was winning so far. He seemed invincible, uncatchable. He didn't make any mistakes, and didn't leave any clues. He was very sure of himself. He even left me a cute little postcard for sport. What should that tell me? He might have read my book about Gary Sonogy, I thought. He just might have read my book. Had he taken Naomi to challenge me? Maybe to prove how good he was. I didn't like that thought very much. Chapter 33
I'm alive, but I'm in hell.
Kate McTiernan tucked her legs close against her chest and shivered. She was certain that she'd been drugged. Severe tremors, accompanied by gnawing nausea, swept over her in powerful waves that would not stop no matter what she tried. She didn't know how long she had been asleep on the cold floor and what time it was now. Was he watching her? Was there a peephole hidden in the walls? Kate could almost feel his eyes crawling all over her. She remembered every gruesome and hideous detail of the rape. The feel of it was so vivid.
The thought of being touched by him was repulsive, and the most horrifying images snapped at her. Anger, guilt, violation all fused in her mind. Adrenaline surged powerfully through her body.
Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee.
She thought she had forgotten how to pray. She hoped that God hadn't forgotten her.